you know, hiring is a big deal and you shouldn't take it lightly. But I think sometimes early on it's scary and you're worried about losing control and giving things up and things changing. At least I was. And thus far, that has never happened.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Gregory Koberger. Gregory is the founder of README. They're a company that helps dev teams create and manage documentation and monitor APIs. He founded README after working at several startups in the Valley, including Mozilla. He wrote a lot of documentation there and saw a better way. I'm really excited about this episode because we talk about challenge coins. This is a totally new concept for me. It's a way to build community with a physical object. We talk about how to use human connection to drive out toxicity, especially on remote or distributed teams. And we talk about how to build a technical interview that doesn't feel like a pop quiz. And now, here's my conversation with Gregory Koberger. Greg, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
What is the biggest inflection point in your career that's gotten you to where you are today?
Ooh, great question. I don't know. There's been a lot of little inflection points here or there, obviously. I think the biggest one that comes to mind is the most disruptive in my life, which was I was in college a few years ago or many years ago, and I had a job offer at a local web development agency for nonprofits in Rochester, New York. And I was going to take it because, you know, they came to me. It seemed like a good enough job and all that. And one of my professors, someone named Liz Lawley, really liked me from class because I think it was a like HTML 101 class. It was a pretty, you know, basic class. And I already knew HTML and CSS and all that stuff, basic web development stuff. And rather than blowing off the class, I put some effort into it and did some cool, interesting new stuff. And I kind of took it as a chance to not to just blow off the class and get a good A or easy A, but to try new things and all that. And she liked me and introduced me to one of her previous students, a guy named Eric, who was starting a company in San Francisco. And ended up just getting the job there, the internship, based on her recommendation, and left upstate New York and went to California. And I think that feels like the biggest inflection point. It's where I kind of discovered my love for startups. I've worked at some bigger companies since then, which we will talk about, but I just kind of fell in love with startups. It kind of set the tone for what I thought a startup could and should be. That first startup was called Offbeat Guides. It hasn't been around for almost a decade now. It didn't work out for them, but it completely modeled how I think about startups and how to build a company and how to run a team and things like that. And very few things have had that much of an impact on me. And I have stayed in California since then. And it's kind of that was like the big inflection point, I think.
So instead of staying in New York, building websites for local mom and pop shops, you're out to building startups. Yeah, that seems like a pretty good divergence. Nice job, professor.
Yeah, still appreciate that she kind of helped me out there.
It's surprising how often that inflection point is someone introducing someone to someone else. That's a common pattern. It seems like that's a thing I wish I could do more of in my life. How can I help more people make those connections?
Agreed.
I want to hear more about your startup-themed escape room that you ran in San Francisco. What is a startup-themed escape room?
Okay. So have you done any escape rooms before?
I have.
Okay. So a few years ago, I got into escape rooms with the person I was dating at the time. We were in Wisconsin and needed something to do, and we got into them. And I started doing a ton. And then I was like, this would be good for team bonding. So I took my team, and we started doing them.
Yep.
We do a lot of offsites in different places. We just did one in Minnesota last week or 2 weeks ago. And there's always new escape rooms. And it's a really good team bonding thing that you get to spend time with your team. It's can be a little awkward or a little cheesy, but there's no alcohol involved, which is really nice. We still go to bars and stuff like that. But I like finding things that don't involve alcohol for the team to do. And it involves, it's one of the few things you can do for an hour that's engaging and fun. You're all working together. You're not drinking. And it's good for team bonding, I think. So we've been doing those for a while. And a few years ago, about 2 years ago, I had the idea to build a parody of a startup as an escape room. So escape rooms often tend to be scary or Sherlock Holmes themed or prison themed, something dire or dour. And I thought I could take that formula, which is you have 1 hour to solve a bunch of clues. And instead of making it scary or anything like that. I can make it fun and funny and make it startup related. And since I already thought escape rooms were great for teams, I thought it would be great to kind of build one specifically for team bonding. I was working at my current company, ReadMe, then, still am here. And I just kind of got a little, my job had been changing where I was no longer programming or designing anymore. I was now managing and running the company. And I love that, but I also really miss the tactile, like actually building and making things. So I rented an art gallery, and on nights and weekends, I started building this escape room. And it's, I launched and it's a real business. It's still there. You can go to it. It's called Startup Escape in San Francisco. And, you walk in and like it looks like a cliche startup environment. There's colorful motivational posters on the walls. There's a bunch of laptops and computers all over. There's like a swag closet. It looks like a real startup, but it turns out like everything is part of, is a clue. Like the startup books like 0 to 1 and all that, like there's clues hidden inside those. And it's 5 different tracks: programming, design, IT, marketing, and DevOps. And each of the clues, you don't have to program to do the escape room, but it feels like the clues under the programming track are very logical and it feels like you're programming, things like that. So yeah, that was kind of how I got into building an escape room. It was a combination of really liking escape rooms and really liking the Silicon Valley startup culture, but kind of feeling like it's kind of negative in the past few years, and it's gotten bigger, and like it's no longer this fun thing that we're all doing. It's like a real startup CEOs are sitting in front of Congress now, and they're changing the world, stuff like that. And that's great. But I still like the fun. Like startups are supposed to be fun in my mind. And I wanted to kind of like do more things to make tech seem fun.
Yeah, it's no longer the obvious countercultural thing to do. It's kind of like...
Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
And you've kind of... You're thinking through tropes and what's the startup cliches. Has any of those led to how you think about culture and what kind of company you want to build with ReadMe?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to take yourself too seriously as a startup. And you want to be serious about your work, but you don't want to take yourself too seriously, I think. And I did a lot of freelancing before I did ReadMe, before I started ReadMe. And I worked with a lot of different teams. And the ones that always seemed to succeed the most were the ones who were having fun with it, who enjoyed their jobs. And at the end of the day, like, there's some stuff that's not fun about startups. It's still a job. Like, I'm not expecting it to be like going into, it's still a job. But I think we're so lucky that we get to work at cool startups like this and do fun things and get to like kind of build whatever we want, not whatever we want to build, but within reason. And I wish that people get way too serious and they overwork themselves. And at the end of the day, we're just building a product. And I love our product. I love our company. And I want to succeed, but not at the cost of people's sanity or happiness or personal lives.
And how have take yourself too seriously, kill yourself trying to make this thing work? That's something that you reject. Is that a fair?
Yeah, and it's not to say that we don't work really hard, but there's no expectation that people work, late into the night every day or weekends. There's no expectation that if like someone does something wrong and messes something up or breaks something that they're going to get in trouble. And it's created a culture where people just love working with each other. We do better work because we're all on the same page, things like that.
So part of that, I would say that kind of avoiding the toxic culture of overwork and short-termism, what are some things you do to safeguard against that kind of toxicity at ReadMe?
Yeah, that's always really tough. I think every company has like a, we don't hire assholes policy or whatever, somewhat on the books. And I've seen a lot of blog posts about it and all that. But it's tough. Things still can creep in. One of the biggest things that we do is, so we're at the point where we have very distinct teams. We have engineering teams. We have sales teams. And I think that's a lot of times when companies can start going downhill. When you have a team of people that is in their own silo. For us, our sales team is in Columbus, so they're not even in San Francisco. And, you have a support team that's siloed. And I think that's a huge problem where I don't think anyone's a jerk at companies necessarily. It might just be that they don't really know the rest of the team and see the rest of the team. So it's very easy to be a jerk if, the person that you're talking to is just a screen name on Slack or something like that, or you don't even know who they are. So we work really hard. We do, like I said, we do quarterly offsites, someplace cool. We've done everywhere from like Thailand and Hawaii all the way to like, places close to San Francisco, like Sonoma and Napa and Tahoe. But every quarter we go someplace, and that's been phenomenal for keeping the toxicity out, because it humanizes everyone, and people who wouldn't have been friends randomly, like just at these offsites, become friends. And we work really hard to have a bunch of like fun events and have people talk and run sessions. And I think that's been the number one thing we've done for team bonding that keeps everyone from being toxic and from being mean, because you know, it's really easy to be mean if you're a salesperson. You lose a deal because, you know, the feature that you needed wasn't built in time. But if you know the person, it's not just like, oh, that stupid engineer. It's, oh, Tom. There is no Tom in my company, but so I'm not picking on anyone. But like, oh, Tom, you know, I get it. It just makes it a lot easier and a lot smoother. And everyone's kind of on the same page and talks and feels comfortable talking to each other and has some sort of personal relationship with pretty much everyone else on the team.
One challenge I've had with those sort of events is people's natural tendency to kind of group with the folks they already know, the people already on their team. I'd imagine that's especially challenging if you've got the Columbus team and San Francisco team. How do y'all break through that and get folks mixing together?
Luckily, I think it's because so early on we've established this. It hasn't really been a problem. Like I 100% understand that that's a possibility, but so far that hasn't happened. At the offsites, we do a lot of different things where we'll do like dinners and we'll split people up randomly. We do escape rooms, like I said, so people are split up randomly. We try to kind of mingle people and split people up, but so far that hasn't really been a problem somehow, which is lucky, I guess. We do enough things where people are kind of either forced to split up or want to split up into different groups that of course there's some, you know, cliques that are based on jobs, but that usually tends to be newer people. And then by the end of the offsite, they've dispersed and met a bunch of new people, and luckily it hasn't been too much of a problem. We also do something. Are you familiar with donut.com?
Yeah, we just started using it a few weeks ago. Do you want to explain to the audience what Donut is?
Yeah, so Donut is they might do other things as well, but definitely they have a Slack bot, and you put it in. We have a BFF channel and, you know, Best Friends Forever channel. I don't know what it's called that, but the donut bot's in it. And anyone in the company who's in this donuts channel or this BFF channel, every week they will get paired up with someone random at the company and have to have some sort of like, if they're in person, they go get dessert. If it's a remote person, in person, or like if it's two remote people, a Skype session, and usually like people will like order some sort of cake or donut or whatever via like Uber Eats or something. So it's very dessert based. That part is not due to donut.com. That's us taking the donut thing very literally. You know, I take people to there's a game room nearby with like it's like a sports bar, but they're open all day, and like they have like a whole floor of just games. So it's kind of like a Dave and Buster's type thing. So I take people there and play games. Like you can do whatever you want with it, but it's a chance once a week to kind of meet with someone that you wouldn't have a one-on-one with and just talk about fun stuff. It's not about work. Even like when I get paired up with my direct reports, we don't talk about work stuff. We talk about like, how's life going? Stuff like that. So by the time offsites roll around, everyone has spent, you know, an hour with, 4, 5, 6, 7 different people in the company. And, that's not part of their org. So, I think that's a really good kind of like prep for these offsites.
That makes a lot of sense. I think there's, it's easy to underestimate the friction of having that first meeting with someone. Like the very first time seems like, 10 or 100 times harder than the second time. So I love like hacks like that to get around that like static friction.
Yep. I have a friend and she worked at the company, and she was early on in the company, and her thing was she would get coffee with every single person at the company. She would just reach out to them like on their first week or two. And I was always so impressed by that because I can't do that. I mean, I do that because it's my company and I talk to everyone, but I don't think I'd have the ability to kind of just be an IC and work at a company and like actually go out of my way to maintain this for like up to like 100, 200 people. It's such a good idea. So if you don't use Donut, first of all, I think it's worth bringing into a company. I've recommended a lot of people do it. But even if you don't do that, like just reaching out, it's everyone wants, no one's going to say no to that. And it's such a good way to kind of know people across the company. And then as the company gets bigger, when you need something, it's so nice to kind of be like, oh yeah, I know them. And you don't have to be like best friends or anything, but it's so nice to just be able to kind of like be a friend or a person as opposed to like someone who needs something.
Absolutely. Being more than just a Slack handle. I like the way you said that.
That should be their donuts slogan, be more than just a Slack handle.
I hear that, Donut. We'll give that away for free. for you.
Not for free. Let's see if we get a discount. Ooh, you and okay. I can both get a few months free on Donut for that.
I take it back. Discount. That's what we want. So let's talk about hiring. Yes. It is very clear you've put a lot of thought into your hiring process. We'll link to the blog post about how you run your transparent hiring process. Could you kind of walk us through the problems you solved in the typical Silicon Valley process and how you try to address those at README?
I have been on both sides of the interview process many times. When I worked at different companies, I was interviewing candidates. When I was doing freelancing for a few years, and every once in a while I would be like, oh, I should probably apply for a job or something. So I spent a lot of time like doing technical interviews, and I wasn't really looking for a job, but if someone reached out and, you know, money was a little low for contracting, I'd be like, well, I guess I could interview. So I spent a lot of time on both sides. And when I started a company, I knew that there's a lot of things I really hated about the technical interview. I think that technical interviews all too often become a kind of a pop quiz on, do you know the same things I know when it comes to programming? I'm talking just about technical interviews, but I think we apply the same feelings to non-technical interviews as well. And I hate that. Like, I hate these, like, I've been to interviews where they're like, you know, how would you optimize this website? And I'm like, well, here's these 12 things. And they'll be like, well, you didn't think of this 13th or 14th thing. Or they'll be like, you know, okay, we're going to write JavaScript. Do you know this random JavaScript trivia that I know? Or like basic CS stuff. Like, do you know how to do a, you know, the cliche like binary tree sort, or that's not even a thing, but whatever. And I just felt like it attracted the wrong kinds of people. And there's some really amazing people who can nail those interviews, but we're competing against thousands and thousands of other companies in San Francisco. So we have to find a process that is unique to us, that finds really amazing people, that, you know, gives us an advantage against all these other companies that are hiring. So the thing we do is twofold. One is that we make sure that everyone knows from start to finish what's going on. And two is, and I'll get back to that. And two is that we let people bring their own projects. So as far as the transparency, so if you were to apply to README, and then, you know, we hopped on the phone and we did a 15-minute call. During that 15-minute call, I ask people two questions. I talk about README as well and tell them why, you know, we're cool and all that. But the two questions I ask are, what's something really amazing that you've built or made or done? If it's someone who is not technical, then I'll focus on like what's something amazing you've done. But if it's someone who's a little more technical, I'll ask what's something amazing that you've built. And the reason why I like that question is I don't really care what they say at all. I've heard some of the most unique, random things people have said. I just like people who can get excited about something, about whatever it is. You know, if they answer like, well, I wrote like a metric server at our last company. And if I dig into it, I'm like, well, why'd you do that? And they're like, well, my boss told me to. And they're like, well, like what language was it written in? And they're like, well, Python. And I'll say like, well, were there any downsides of using Python? And if they're like, I don't know. That doesn't excite me. But like when someone like, okay, I can't see them because it's on the phone, but like when their like eyes light up and they're just like, they just want to tell you about this like thing they've built. If they can get excited about that, they can get excited about anything or my company. And that's my first question that I really love to ask. And not only do I get the excitement of people, you can also tell their depth of knowledge. You can't do it if you just get started, I don't think, but like I've been interviewing long enough that I've gotten really good at understanding people's depth of knowledge with the way they answer questions. So like I'll dig in and I'll be like, oh, so why did you choose to write that with Mongo? And just from the way they talk about it, I can get a pretty good sense on whether or not they made a educated choice or not. And maybe the answer is literally, I've never used Mongo before. I just wanted to try it out for the first time. That's a good answer too. But then I'll dig in and be like, well, you know, what were the pros and cons of using Mongo? And I think pretty quickly, anyone who I want to work with has a pretty okay answer to that question. So that's kind of like a twofold. I can get the excitement out of people and see if they actually like built something or made something or done something. And then I can kind of like dig into the technical stuff pretty easily.
So it sounds like first criteria is, can you get excited about something you've done or built? And you find that that's predictive of people that are really successful on your team. Second thing is, can they just, it sounds like you're diving into trade-offs. Can they talk about trade-offs and decisions they made? Is that really what that second one is about?
Yeah, I think it doesn't always go that route, but that does tend to be kind of the best way I find to understand. Like it's, for example, let's say that, I don't know how technical the audience tends to be, but like, I always find like, if we're talking about something, for example, and, like Mongo, back to this example, and They're building a little side project that, you know, 10 people are going to use. And they start talking about, oh, Mongo's not good because of scaling. Then my mindset is, oh, you just read that someplace. Like, you, that's not true.
Mongo is web scale. Not good. I'm not sure if you realized.
I've heard that. But it's one of those things where, like, does Mongo have scaling problems? 100%. Like, but if people are over optimizing, worrying about scaling problems, you know, when they have like 5-10 people using it, like, it's clear that they didn't really think about the technology, if that's kind of their con or stuff like that. And like, it's very easy to quickly figure out if people know what they're talking about or just parroting back something that they had heard previously. And obviously everything is, you know, parroting back something you had heard at some point and all that. But I think it's pretty easy to, you know, if they say the cons are like, oh, the cons are like, you know, it's not going to scale well if we have like a billion users, but we'll deal with that when we get to it. Like, that shows a better understanding than someone who's like trying to optimize Mongo when they have, you know, 5 or 6 users and things like that. Okay, I think digging into trade-offs is a really good way to quickly understand what people think, because like getting the cons out of them is just as good as getting the pros. And there's a con to literally everything. There's not a single technology out there that's not a trade-off. And, you know, having people be able to like explain why that trade-off didn't matter or why it was a trade-off, is really a good way to kind of delve in, I think.
So we've got that first 15-minute call. We've talked about trade-offs. We've got two excitements. And then what do we do?
Yes. So then let's say we like them. Next step. Oh, sorry. The second question I ask is where you want to be in 5 years. And I don't care what the answer is. There's no right or wrong answer. And I definitely don't expect anyone to have an answer. Like, no one can really kind of call their shot like that and be like, in 5 years, I will be blank. But I'd like to kind of like make sure that we're a good fit just as much as they're a good fit for us. If they say they want to, you know, start a company, then I think that's we're a good place to kind of like spend a few years understanding how to start a company. We're small enough where you can kind of still be involved in a lot of different things. But if they say something completely different, you know, there's no wrong answer, but I just want to make sure that we're a good fit and that, no one at this company is going to be here 20, 30, 40 years from now, most likely. And probably, on a much shorter time scale, it's going to be true as well. Like, at some point, I'm going to do something else as well. And that's okay. My point isn't that I want them to leave anytime soon. It's that I want to make sure that when they leave, they're better off than when they started. Otherwise, it's kind of a very adversarial relationship over the next few years. And that's a vague question, but, I've never like not hired someone because they answered that question a way I didn't like, but it does help me understand what that person, what motivates them, what drives them, like what they're thinking, and kind of recontextualizes them as a person pretty early on. So that's the two questions I ask. Then let's say that we like them. We move them on to the next steps. So at that point, they're going to get a website. We have a custom built hiring website thing that we have, and they'll be able to see, you know, their information, everyone who's interviewing them. We have like in the blog post that you're going to post, there's a screenshot of it, but it talks about like, you know, different things. Like, we like when you Google, don't feel bad about Googling. Here's what to bring to the interview. Here's what to prepare. Here's the types of questions we're going to ask you. And we just make it so that people are very, they know exactly what to expect, with the company. And that's awesome because they come in a little more confident, a little more in knowing what to expect. There's no surprises. And it's been one of the best things that we've gotten is, you know, the best feedback we've gotten is that it's really helpful for people. And then the last thing we do for interviewing, is we ask people for technical interviews, we ask people to bring their own project. So at no point do we, you know, make a decision based on you, based on, you know, we give you a problem and you sit there and solve it in front of us. We do live coding and all that, but we'd have you bring your own project to us. And the reason I really like that is because if you work at README for 3 months as an engineer, you start to get used to the code base and start to understand it. And you understand why decisions are being made. And you understand like how to jump around to different files and how we write tests and things like that. And I want to mimic that as much as possible. And I just think if you're nervous in an on-site interview,
which almost everybody is.
Yeah, exactly. And you're using like a tech stack that's not exactly yours. You don't know exactly where everything is. And you're trying to solve a problem that you just heard about 30 seconds ago. Like, you go with, for example, like, let's say that I ask you to do blank. Like, you just go with whatever is the first thing that comes to mind. And then the interviewer is trying to get more information out of you. And they're like, well, why did you do that? And like, you're trying to like justify it and explain it. But the honest answer is like, you were a little nervous. You didn't have much time to think about the problem. And you just kind of like started writing code. And you're using an environment you're not familiar with. Like, it's just, it's, you don't understand the worst thing too is that the interviewer doesn't realize it, but they have done this a few times and they have so much more knowledge about the problem than you do, that a lot of things that seem obvious or common sense to the interviewer aren't true. Or sometimes the interviewer will have like their set way of doing things that they believe is the best way to do it, but like the interviewee might do a different way. And it's very hard for interviewers to take a step back and be like, oh yeah, that's a really good way as well. And I'm being a little abstract there, but I love it when people bring their own projects, because then when you ask them questions, you get a thoughtful answer back. So you can say, well, why'd you do that? And they're like, well, and the answer isn't just spanning the past 5 minutes, spanning the past 5 weeks, 5 months. We've had people do things like come in and be like, I want to learn React. I've never done React before. I'm going to do a to-do list in React. And like, we judge them differently. We judge them based on not how good this to-do list is, but like, oh, look at the way they've like figured out a brand new language they've never done before. Some people will add a feature to an app that already exists. Some people will be like, we had one person who wanted to build a Chrome extension for the first time. And we didn't judge them based on how good they did the Chrome extension. We did it based on like how well they figured things out and understood the problems and, you know, the idea behind it and like why they picked to do this. And like, you just get so much more out of this interview, I think, when you ask people to bring their own projects. It's been one of my favorite innovations we've had. And, I absolutely love doing it.
Yeah. It seems like you're able to see people closer to the natural environments. My follow-up question was going to be, what if someone doesn't have a side project? Because I think there are some people that don't. It sounds like in that case, they're just like, come learn React with us. Let's do build a to-do list.
Yeah. So we make it very clear that either work on a project you're already working on or start something new they've been wanting to do forever. I think most people have something they've been wanting to do forever. And let's say that that's not true. We have a few stock projects that we give people as well. So and we have laptops too that people can use if they don't have a laptop. So if those things don't work out for you, that's totally fine. We've definitely hired people who have not brought their own project and use one of our stock ones. And that's fine as well. But, you know, worst case scenario, you get a interview experience that is similar to other companies. Best case scenario, you get to show off something cool you've been building. So it works pretty well for us.
I love that. I'm going to switch gears and go back to culture.
Okay.
You use challenge coins at your culture. What is a challenge coin and what do they do?
Yeah. Are you familiar with challenge coins?
I'm not.
Okay. So challenge coins from the start of the military. And the whole point is, let's say that you are in some sort of battalion or troop or we're in a battle. You would get this challenge coin, which is this like thick metal coin. And the whole point of it would be that if you were ever challenged, you could like show your coin and be like, see, this is proof that I was, you know, on this battalion or whatever. And there's a game around it where if someone challenges you and you have your challenge coin, they have to buy you a drink. If they challenge you and you don't have it, then you have to buy them a drink. So that's what the kind of challenge is. And people, if you look at, like, if you ever watch, like, the president, any president, in the, Oval Office, there's always a row of coins behind him or her. And it's a bunch of challenge coins, because when, people from the military meet presidents, it's become a tradition to give them a challenge coin. Or if, you know, fortunately someone dies, maybe their family will mail a challenge coin to the White House, things like that. So there's a lot of like, it's steeped in kind of like this military culture. I didn't get it from there though. I got it from a guy named Jon Favreau, who is a director of Lion King, Jungle Book, Iron Man. He was Monica's rich boyfriend and Friends is how most people know him the best as an actor, but he's a director, and he gave out these challenge coins to everyone that worked on his movies. So every time he does a new movie, he gets a bunch of challenge coins made, and there's something I really, really liked about it. He gave it to everyone who was involved in the production of the movie. So let's say that, you know, The Lion King, like Beyonce and Childish Gambino will get a challenge coin, but so will the people who worked on the craft services table. So will like the makeup people, or nope, there's no makeup in that. But if there was, the makeup people, all that. And I think that the thing I really like about that is, you know, obviously I think Beyonce probably makes a little bit more money than, you know, a VX artist, but they're all equally important in building this movie or, you know, in my case, a company. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways where people get rewarded in different ways, but I really like this kind of, everyone gets a challenge coin. They're all numbered chronologically. On the front of them, they have our mascot, Albert, on it. It says, "In Albert we trust," and all that. And there's a credits page as well. If you go to readme.com/credits, you can see everyone who's gotten a challenge coin. And I just, it's a really nice way to kind of like build a culture and, you know, show everyone that they were important to the company and valuable and kind of create this like club of people who are like this like readme family. As time's gone on, the bar has gotten higher. Like early on, it was people who like gave me really good advice or like were really helpful early on. Now it's mostly employees and investors and things like that. Yeah, so that's the challenge coins, and everyone who works at Readme gets one. Any of our investors get them. Anyone who like helps Readme, the kind of the litmus test for these is: would Readme exist the way it does now if it wasn't for you? And if the answer is no, then we give you a challenge coin.
So if I wanted to go earn a challenge coin, I could go take one of your open source projects and make a big dent in it and make it better.
Yes. Like, do stuff like that. And just kind of like find a way to kind of like make Readme so that if it wasn't for you, it wouldn't exist in the way it currently does.
I think it's easy to underestimate how much those physical artifacts sometimes matter. Like I started the company, worked there for 10 years, and we sold the company. It's great. I feel good about it. But the only artifacts I have like a little plaque that we did at the sale, and I have like two t-shirts, and I care so much for those t-shirts, like an irrational amount. So this coin kind of gets that same, that emotion rubs off. I really like that idea.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Like you can't keep most of the other stuff when it comes to a company. They're not tangible. And the tangible stuff, it doesn't matter except for the fact that it's it harkens back to, like you said, 10 years of your life.
Yeah, it's just a handle for all those other actual feels that matter. The actual culture is not physical, but I think those physical objects can give us a tag into it.
Definitely agree.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help high-growth teams hire better-fit developers faster with less engineering effort. We do that by finding hidden gems in your candidate pool. 1/3 of our customer hires are folks that would have been rejected with a standard resume screen. That means faster hiring and better fit. And we deliver a great candidate experience, complete with detailed feedback. And instead of taking it from me, I think you should hear from one of our customers' candidates. Here is a real quote from a real software engineer about our work simulations and feedback.
This assessment service is awesome. I must say that this is my most pleasant online coding challenge so far.
If you want to judge for yourself, we'd be happy to build you a tailored demo that you can play with on your own time. Go to woventeams.com/demo to get started. That's woventeams.com/demo. So let's go back to hiring.
Yes.
If you could go back in time to the day you demoed at YC and you're walking off the stage and you say, "Past Greg," and you wanted to give advice about hiring, what advice would you give to past Greg about hiring?
So when I left YC and had a little bit of money in our bank account, I was always a little, I was very apprehensive about hiring. For the first year after that, I was very slow at hiring because every new person you add to a company changes it. So for example, when it was just me and I hired the second person, all of a sudden 50% of the people at the company were like this like unknown quantity or quality. And that was really scary to me. And I was really worried constantly that every hire I made would ruin the company culture. Because in my mind, we had a company culture, whatever that happens to mean, however you define company culture, that I really liked. And, you know, let's say we had three people. The fourth person could potentially ruin the company culture. And that was always scary to me. Or the fifth person. And like, as time goes on, there's people have less ability to kind of like, you know, ruin a culture. I wish I had thought about it differently. I wish I had thought about it as not, you know, when I hire someone, they have the potential to ruin the company culture, but rather when I hire someone, the company culture is going to expand and get much, much better. And that's what happened with us. Like every time we hired, a month later, I was like, I can't believe we were so slow to hire this. This person's like changed everything for the better. And it's a lot of pressure to kind of like maintain a company culture when you think of it as that, when you think of it as like, this is our company culture, it can't change. When you think of it as, there's so many people out there who can expand and improve the company culture, it gets pretty exciting. And you know, it's hiring is a big deal and you shouldn't take it lightly, But I think sometimes early on, it's scary and you worry about losing control and giving things up and things changing. At least I was. And thus far, that has never happened. And every single person I've hired has been has brought something new to the table and changed the company in a good way. And I wish I kind of realized that earlier on, that hiring is very scary because it's a big commitment, but not nearly as scary as it seemed back then. And the upsides are 10 times better.
My guest today has been Greg Koberger. Greg, thank you for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Gregory for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, humanizing teammates prevents toxicity. Quarterly offsites are fun. You can go to Napa or Tahoe, but what value do we get? The real value there, especially for distributed teams, is to eliminate jerks. I don't mean we're going to murder our jerks. I mean, we're going to eliminate the tendency for people to treat each other like jerks when they don't know the human on the other side of their behavior. If we lack the context and connection with our teammates, it's easy to be a jerk. When we go to an offsite, it's important. Gregory mixes his teams. So if all of customer success is sticking together, all of engineering is sticking together, that's much less effective than mixing these teams. Imagine a situation where a salesperson misses a deal because a feature slipped. It would be much easier for that salesperson to get upset with dev and write them all off if they didn't know the person, the engineer on that project specifically. We understand individual humans. It's easier for us to treat abstract functions and teams as a jerk. So they split people up at these offsites and cultural events, and they also use Donut, a Slack bot, to randomly pair folks up for calls and meetings. Number two, your technical interview should not feel like a pop quiz. A specific anti-goal for README's technical interview is to be a pop quiz that answers the question, do you know what I know? It's really easy for engineers to build technical interviews that are just, I know this thing, do you also know it? Do you know this random JavaScript trivia, of which there is infinite? There are amazing people that can nail those interviews. And if we're competing for with the other 1,000 companies who can nail those interviews, we're not going to find talent differently. It's going to be tough to compete along that exact same dimension. A question that gets us out of this pop quiz mode is what's something amazing that you've built or done? We can see someone get excited. Where do you want to be in 5 years? This is a pretty standard interview question. And the value here is not their answer specifically. It's to make sure that we're aligned on the time frame and goals. I think the value in this particular question is follow-up. So if someone says they want to be a manager in 5 years, and you know that that's maybe not in the cards for your growth trajectory, it gives you an opportunity to say, actually, it's probably going to be 6 or 7 years to be a manager in this role. Is that a problem? And then maybe they say, yeah. And then you've just saved both of you a year of pain. README also built a custom website. Each interview candidate gets a page with instructions on how to prepare the interview, what to wear, where to go, what questions they'll ask, and who you'll be interviewing with. This prep guide is amazing. We're going to link it in the show notes. They also do something interesting with their technical skills assessment in that they ask candidates to bring their own project so they can talk about a project that they're already familiar with, which is kind of the steady state for engineering. They also provide some out-of-the-box projects for folks who really haven't worked on anything on the side recently. Number three, we can use physical artifacts like challenge coins to build community. The concept of a challenge coin started in the military. These are thick metal coins that, you know, feel really good in your hand, that is proof of what battalion you're in or what battle you're in. If someone challenges you, you weren't in that battle, and you have your coin, then they have to buy you a drink. It's kind of a friendly wager. John Favreau, the director, he gives challenge coins to everyone who is on a movie. Anyone who is on the set, from the lead actor down to the person who does the craft services table. This ties everyone together. Everyone had an important part in that movie. So it's a physical coin that levels everyone as a contributor. At README, Greg uses challenge coins for the same purpose, to build community. His test is, would README exist in this form without you? If the answer is no, then they get a challenge coin. So this means advisors, employees, contractors, everyone is eligible and everyone's part of the same community. Thanks again to Gregory for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.